From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're getting more announcements today about cabinet appointments from the Trump transition team. Multiple media outlets are reporting that former Labor Secretary Elaine Chao is Trump's nominee for Transportation Secretary. She is the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. NPR has not yet confirmed that news. The president-elect has also nominated Georgia Congressman Tom Price to be Health and Human Services Secretary. And joining us now for more on all of this is NPR's Tam Rakeith. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
And let's start with Tom Price. Who is he and why did Trump nominate him?
Well, so he is a member of Congress, has been since 2005, and is an outspoken critic of Obamacare, or also known as the Affordable Care Act. He's an orthopedic surgeon, chairman of the House Budget Committee, also on the Ways and Means Committee, which does taxes. And he has been really a strong voice against the Affordable Care Act. He would like to replace it with sort of a mix of things, expanding health savings account, making it savings accounts, making it so people could buy health insurance across state lines, and tort reform, preventing malpractice lawsuits or reducing malpractice lawsuits. It's not clear that that actually would be a replacement for Obamacare, but that's what he has talked about. He also favors at least partially privatizing Medicare and is on board with the proposal from the House Speaker that would raise the eligibility age for Medicare. So, you know, if personnel is policy, then This is a very clear signal from the president-elect that he plans to follow through and follow through quickly on his promise that he made throughout the campaign to repeal and replace Obamacare.
And what about Elaine Chao, who, as we said, was George W. Bush's labor secretary and the wife of Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, as a possible nominee for transportation?
You know, the thing that's interesting about her is she's sort of the ultimate Washington insider. When Mitch McConnell was running for re-election and at the time he would then become the majority leader, one of the concerns about his wife being on the campaign trail too much is that she would make him seem like he had gone Washington and was too much of an insider and not enough of an outsider. She has a lot of experience, cabinet-level experience, administrative experience. Fun fact, she would become the second woman to be both a labor secretary, transportation secretary, and wife of the Senate Majority Leader, the first being Elizabeth Dole, who was married to who is married to Bob Dole.
That is a fun fact, Tam. Thank you.
Fun fact.
And now, what about the big position that people have been talking about? Secretary of State. We know that Trump is meeting for a second time tonight with Mitt Romney over dinner. Yesterday, Trump met with former CIA chief David Petraeus. What's the latest on the Secretary of State nomination?
Well, this has been a very contentious position. Obviously, it's a very important position. It's the public face of the United States of America to countries all over the world. There has been sort of internal strife about that pick, internal strife that became externally visible to everyone when Kellyanne Conway, who is an advisor to the president-elect, went on the Sunday talk shows and was openly critical of Mitt Romney. Now, of course, Mitt Romney had been openly critical of Donald Trump throughout the process, throughout the primary process, and had just been very critical of Trump. So there's this sort of internal divide over whether it's a good idea to bring in someone like Mitt Romney, who truly was a rival. There's always this talk of, a cabinet of rivals. But that would be another step. And so, but on the other hand, Mitt Romney is widely respected and has sort of a diplomatic temperament.
Right.
That is very much still up in the air. There are lots of other people, David Petraeus, Senator Corker, and even still possibly former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, all still potentially in that mix.
Meanwhile, Trump is not tweeting about that. He's been tweeting about voter fraud. He has been tweeting about flag burning. He's been attacking CNN. What's that all about? A lot of people are looking at those tweets and saying he's just doing this to distract from something else.
Yeah, and attacking a CNN reporter individually,
yeah.
Retweeting a bunch of people who had been basically trolling him. So, you know, this has been Donald Trump's modus operandi throughout the campaign, and it hasn't stopped now. And it does do an excellent job. It's like, look at that flashy thing over there. It does this for Donald Trump's purposes. If people are constantly on this treadmill of following the latest thing that he tweeted, then, you know, it changes the subject. One subject that has been on the front page of many papers recently, and on our air as well, is the idea of conflicts of interest with Donald Trump's business dealings. And today on the transition call, his aides were asked about the contract for the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., that appears to say that someone in government can't have a contract with the U.S. government for the lease on the hotel. So they didn't have an answer for that, but that is yet another sort of ongoing issue.
That's Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent. Tam, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, question, how do you cover a president who repeats lies? Donald Trump lies about the popular vote, the New York Times editorial page read yesterday. This was after Trump tweeted that he won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. Secretaries of state who run elections howled, said there was no fraud, except isolated cases like the Trump supporter who voted twice because she thought there was voter fraud and her first vote might not count. As the Times wrote, the claim of millions of illegal voters is a lie. So how to report that? David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, is here now. And David, I said Donald Trump repeats lies. The Times went on to say it's part of a pattern of disregard for indisputable facts. So does that make Donald Trump a chronic liar? And should journalists be more direct and say that?
Such a good question. You know, I think that one in journalism, we tend not to call things lies because lies suggest intent. And we really tend not to call people liars because we can't look into their minds and their hearts. And yet if something is asserted without evidence, indeed in the face of countervailing evidence, and I think that the question of birthers, you know, who made claims about President Obama not being born in this country with all evidence proving he was born in Hawaii when he said he was that it's hard not to look at that and call it a lie. The risk for the press is that if you call things – if you call people names, and particularly if you call people names rather than acts by their names, but you alienate a lot of their supporters and they may not look at you as honest brokers. And that's a dilemma we haven't fully grappled with. You know, I think there's a difference between the New York Times editorial pages doing it and the news pages doing it. But I think on occasion it's important. But language matters. You know, the Times today wrote about issues about what terms we're using right now in talking about a lot of the movements that helped Trump get to the White House. And in passing, they mentioned the question of torture, which for the longest time the New York Times did not use to apply to such things as waterboarding, which clearly under international law absorbed into federal law years ago is torture. It is a violation of the Geneva Conventions and federal law. And yet today, if you looked in their news pages on the front page, they called in a subheadline a waterboarding a form of torture. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it is important to be very clear with that. In words that are names, I think we have to be a little more sparing because you want to make sure you reach the public you're trying to help inform.
Right. And inform them. Right. Trump attacked CNN's Jeff Zeleny, called him a part-time journalist after Zeleny was looking into voter fraud. Zeleny tweeted back, full-time journalist here looking for examples of voter fraud. What about that? Should journalists engage with Donald Trump on Twitter? And how to cover tweets? It seems you can't ignore a president's tweets. But we've had listeners say that lets Trump steer the conversation, maybe away from policy, for instance.
You know, I think there's a couple layers to this. I think first off, you absolutely can engage with Donald Trump and his campaign on Twitter. You engage with the incoming president of the United States and his team in any way that you can yield something fruitful and acknowledge you're not retreating from the field of holding powerful figures accountable. That's what journalists are supposed to do, you know, at its core, the civic good that we provide. And I think Jeff Zeleny, who I've known for almost two decades, is a tremendous journalist and, you know, unquestionable integrity, who is trying to do his job. David Farenthold, who did such good work and continues to do so, holding Trump accountable for his promises, for what he's done with his charities, a lot of what he did was on Twitter in sort of asking for help in tracking down what now appear to be essentially non-existent Trump donations to veterans groups. You know, he did stuff on Twitter and continually presented complex questions on Twitter to the Trump campaign, in part to show the public what he was interested in, and in part to show the Trump campaign that no one could say that he hadn't posed those questions directly and completely. Yeah. In terms of Trump's own tweeting, let me briefly say, I think it's fine. You know, I would love for news organizations, maybe it would be 30 seconds every other hour in our newscast or something. Maybe it would be a box on the inside page of the Washington Post every day, but maybe it's the Trump du jour. And you sort of acknowledge what he's talked about. Maybe it's flag burning. You say this is unconstitutional, and the Senate majority leader of his own party, a new ally, is forthrightly against banning flag burning because it is against the constitutional protections on free speech, and then move on and cover the things that the incoming administration is actually doing.
And of course, we know other presidents have lied. Clinton, I have not had relations. Nixon lied. But according to PolitiFact, only 4% of the fact-checked statements from Donald Trump they found were totally true. So we seem to be in a new arena. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. Thanks as always.
You bet.
Ohio State University will hold a vigil tonight after yesterday's attack that injured 11. Police say 18-year-old Somali student Abdul Razak Ali Artan plowed through a group of people with his car, then slashed others with a knife before he was shot and killed by an officer. On his Facebook page, Artan reportedly wrote he was tired of America interfering with Muslim communities abroad. Police say they're investigating whether this was a terrorist act. Meanwhile, it was a big story and bumped a scheduled guest who coincidentally also wanted to talk about OSU and an earlier headline out of the Buckeyes game against the University of Michigan Wolverines this past weekend. As usual, the teams talked smack on their handheld posters, but this time Ohio made light of the Flint, Michigan water crisis, one side reading, "Michigan girls more diseased than Flint water." Well, that was too much for Melissa Mays. Her three sons have lead poisoning from the Flint water. She's founder of Water You Fighting For, a group raising consciousness about the Flint water crisis. She was shocked and saddened by yesterday's news, but wanted to make a point about the weekend. So we asked her how she felt when she heard about those signs held up at the game.
Well, I was on my way to my friend's wedding reception and somebody sent me the photos and I had to pull over. I was furious. I mean, we get it. There's back and forth with every game, but you don't make fun of a situation where people have literally died. And then it just flooded. My phone flooded all weekend from distraught mothers, angry parents, sick kids, people, you know, wondering why did we get pulled into this and how is it a joke? This is our everyday life, the trauma we live in. How is this funny? And what does it have to do with a college football game?
Well, you wrote a letter to the Ohio State staff. You have the duty to push education and proper behavior from your students, but it looks like this one slipped your radar. It didn't slip ours.
If it doesn't get pointed out as wrong, it's going to continue to happen. And we're living in so much mental health stress here. We've got PTSD. We are traumatized. And so to see people from the outside laughing at us, it does not help. And we are nowhere near healing. And that's just going to set us further back.
And there's a tweet going around from Lulu Brazel. It says, in case anyone was curious, it took 166 bottles of water just to make dinner, which, you know, reflects what you are talking about. How are your children?
My sons have to go through physical therapy because the lead settles in your growth plates. They're 12 and 13. So they're hitting growth spurts where their bones are growing 4 inches at a time, but their muscles and their joints aren't stretching with them. So they can barely stand some days. Mm-hmm. So they're in constant pain and there's nothing you can take for that kind of pain because those growth plates are hardening prematurely. And the headaches are there. I mean, my oldest just had a growth removed from his tongue. We don't know what it was. It was benign, thank God. But he also has to see an endocrinologist next month because there's something wrong with his pancreas. And last night I had a massive seizure. So the next 2 days I get to be in pain. So it's hard to laugh along with these jokes when you are in constant pain and you're opening all these bottles. And Lulu posted that about Thanksgiving. It took us 58 bottles because we used a ton of broth for everything. And that's just one meal. I took a shower this morning. My eyes burned. My chest burns when you breathe it in and your skin bubbles up and people keep sending me pictures of rashes. We're nowhere near better. And we have the state of Michigan telling us it's fine, like they've lied to us for 2.5 years. And then on the cherry on it is people from the outside who actually Ohio has lead problems of their own, laughing at us and making us the butt of a joke for a college football game, which is just ridiculous.
Melissa Mays, again, founder of Water You Fighting For, a group raising awareness about the water crisis. Melissa, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to another set of moms. Their kids in California go to schools segregated both by race and by economic status. Most kids do. It's an educational system that's been described as pretty much two-tiered and unequal. Oakland is a good example. It's one of the most diverse cities in the country, but schools remain deeply segregated. Zadie Stavely from Here and Now contributor KQED met with two families, one white, one black, who tried their own integration experiments.
In North Oakland, 7-year-old Arrow is getting ready for school. He's an exuberant kid, aiming rubber bands into the air around the kitchen this morning. He's also pretty observant.
He asked me in kindergarten. He came home from school one day and he goes, "Mom, am I white?"
This is Arrow's mom, Eleanor Wolfeiler.
And I said, "Yeah, you're white." And he paused and he said, "Are you white?" And I said, "Yep." That is how it is in our family. We're all white. And I was interested in that because, I mean, 6 is pretty old to figure out your race, but it's a lot younger than a lot of white people.
For 2 years, Arrow attended Sankofa Academy, where 73% of the students are African-American and 11% are Latino. Arrow was one of only 2 white kids in his class the first year. The second year, he was the only one.
Most of our white neighbors didn't look at Sankofa. They wouldn't even walk in the door. To us, we wanted to not only walk in the door, but to actually look at what it meant.
What it meant was complicated for Wolfeiler. She says Arrow was happy. Her family felt welcome at the school. But there were challenges that are common in schools that serve mostly low-income children. Arrow had an inexperienced teacher the first year and frequent substitutes the next.
It was sort of like the bottom of the barrel substitutes. I was like watching the children just shut down.
Wolfeiler agonized over what to do, but eventually decided to move Arrow. And he ended up 3 blocks away at Peralta Elementary. Peralta has won awards multiple times, has higher test scores, lower teacher turnover, and here parents pay for classroom helpers.
And he was quick to tell me there's not a lot of black people in his class.
Arrow had ended up in a pretty typical situation for a white child in Oakland. Only 10% of Oakland's public school students are white, but they're concentrated in a handful of schools where they're the majority. The UCLA Civil Rights Project finds the average white student here has a little more than a third of classmates who are from low-income families. In contrast, African-American and Latino students have double that number of classmates in poverty. When you concentrate poverty and wealth like this, it almost always creates separate and unequal schools, like Peralta and Sankofa.
Our kids are used to broken promises.
Dana Sachs is the director of Sankofa's after-school program.
Our middle school students have been waiting since we first had a 6th grade for lockers. And the district keeps saying, "We're going to get you lockers, we're going to get you lockers," and they haven't gotten them. And our kids are like, "Yeah, they're not going to get us lockers. They don't really care about us."
The district recently renovated part of Sankofa and its playground. And this year, it says it's putting more focus on improving academics at Sankofa and a handful of other poor-performing schools. This has pretty much been the equity strategy: make neighborhood schools more attractive.
The system is broken and diseased.
Charles Wilson is the executive director of enrollment at the Oakland Unified School District.
If everybody went to their neighborhood schools, we might be able to see greater mixing, but there's this sort of pantheon of 5 to 6 schools that everybody wants to get into, all above Highway 13.
Middle-class parents are experts at gaming things.
Janelle Scott is an associate professor of education at UC Berkeley. She says districts have to commit to integrating schools and at the same time spread funds and teachers fairly across all schools.
School districts need to be pretty savvy about making sure that there's not this sense that one school is dramatically better than the other school to get into, because parents will find a way to game that.
Like many school districts in California, Oakland Unified, or OUSD, has never implemented a full integration plan. So the school district relies on parents to do it of their own free will.
I hope that, you know, Oakland will mix it up a little bit.
Kristen Smith is a parent leader at Sankofa. She's African American.
For OUSD's portion of it, I would think they would want to make sure that all schools at least appear to parents to be equitably served.
Smith moved her son to Sankofa the same year Eleanor Wolfeiler moved her son out. And right away, Smith saw some differences between Sankofa and her old school, a more diverse school in the Oakland Hills.
At Kaiser, we had wine auctions. At Sankofa, we may have bake sales. A school like Sankofa misses out because our parents are working parents, so they may not be down at the district every day saying, these are the things that we need.
Smith misses the diversity at Kaiser, but she felt the school let her down when she was never told her son had been pulled out for help with reading.
I feel like perhaps if I had not been an African-American parent, I may have received information sooner.
How Smith felt is important, because to successfully integrate, it's not just about getting more white parents to choose low-performing schools. High-performing schools also need to do a better job of welcoming families of color. At Sankofa, Smith says her kids were excited to see more kids who look like them.
As African-American students get older, you can lose yourself in the world because you just don't know anything about your history. You don't know that you come from a strong people. So you have no frame of reference with which to project yourself into the world. And that's something that all the students here receive.
Smith says Sankofa is serving a lot of African-American families who feel unwelcome at other schools. White mom Eleanor Wolfeiler gets that. She says she knows families of color who have decided not to go to her son's new school, Peralta, because there aren't enough African-American teachers or students there. She knows her own children lost something when she moved them to a majority white school.
This seems to me like, you know, the most important project of our time is to deal with equity and to deal with racism and to deal with privilege and, you know, kids getting shot all over the country. Like, this is a big deal. And it's so easy to ignore it. And I'm worried that the more white of a community my kids are in, the easier it is to ignore.
Yet she felt she had to move her child to the higher performing school, the whiter school. For Here and Now, I'm Zadie Stavely.
Imagine if the government suddenly took away the $5 and $10 bills. That's essentially what has happened in India, where the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes are being removed from the currency, sparking protests and long lines at banks. Joining us now from the streets of Kolkata in India is the BBC's Rahul Tandon. And Rahul, why did Prime Minister Narendra Modi decide to do this?
Jeremy, they decided to tackle the problem of black money here in India. If you go to a shop in this country, everyone takes cash. More than 90% of transactions are in cash. I'm just outside a little shop here. Try and use your plastic, they're going to have a shake of the head. And the problem with that is it means that a lot of income is not declared in this country, and the government gets very little tax, 2 to 3% of the population, I believe, to pay it. So the idea was that they announced that they were getting rid of these two currency notes that make up almost 86% of the value of currency in this country. And people were basically told, it's gone. You've got till the 31st of December to go and put it into your bank accounts. And we're bringing in a new note instead. That is the reason to get rid of the huge, huge black economy that exists in India.
And a lot of people very upset about that. But is there a argument to be made that this was necessary?
I think there is. And India is very much a divided country at this moment. On the one hand, you have millions of people who are angry because they're standing in long bank lines to get their own money and they can't get it. Cash machines still 2 weeks on. Most of them don't work. And we also have this huge problem that now there's a massive gap in the currency. You have a 100 rupee note and then you move to a 2,000 rupee note. But go to this shop in front of me again and give it to the shopkeeper. And again, he's going to be shaking his head because he'll say, I have no change. On the other hand, you have millions of people who say India is a country where corruption has become part of the culture. And that needs to change. And if it means it's going to be tough medicine, well, that's something that this country is going to have to stomach. The Indian Prime Minister has asked for 50 days to basically regenerate cash in this country. So far, he's not achieved it. He's got about another 25 left. If he doesn't, those millions of people who are supporting him may decide to move to the other side.
Well, let's listen to some of the people that you have spoken to about this. Here it is.
People are suffering, but they know it's for a better cause. It's a good cause, and something is, you know, good is going to come out of it.
Farmers don't have their money. They don't have their food. It has created a mess in India. They're driving the India into a darkness.
So how long, Rahul, do you think this chaos is going to go on with people who don't have the money they need or can't make transactions?
It's very, very difficult to say, Jeremy. The one problem I think that Mr. Modi has here is that the implementation of his policies are showing you all the problems that exist of doing business in India. Incredibly bureaucratic. And so when you're trying to get currency, and I'm talking to you from one of India's great cities, so imagine the situation in rural India where there are hardly any banks, where there are hardly any cash machines. People are preserving their money. And the danger is that even once the cash comes back into circulation, they may continue to do that. So there are some now predicting that this was one of the fastest growing economies. It may no longer be so because of the Prime Minister's decision.
That's the BBC's Rahul Tandon joining us from a noisy Kolkata, India. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
It is time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Anthony Valadez is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He's with us now. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and it's great to have you back. And let's get to some of the music you brought us. You wanted us to hear the LA artist Pegasus Warning. This is Building a Bridge.
By the light of the moon, I can see that your heart has been revealed to me. No shame in the game when you play the blame. When you hide, don't say what you mean to say to me. Like I'm drowning in a ocean, deeper than an ocean. You think I like devotion? That's just troubled emotion.
Well, tell us about Pegasus Warning.
Pegasus Warning is Guillermo E. Brown, originally from New York City and part of the free jazz movement out there as a percussionist and drummer. And he's now based in L.A., and your listeners might have seen him on the Late Late Show with James Corden. He's in the house band known as Karen, which is MD'd musically directed by Reggie Watts. And I know Pegasus Warning as a jazz drummer, but when he dropped this EP entitled PWEP2, I didn't know that he was a vocalist, singer, songwriter, and a performer. And also a little interesting fact, I didn't know this about him, that he was also an NYU professor teaching Afrofuturism and experimental music. So really interesting cat.
Interesting guy. And what caught your attention about this song?
I think it was the catchy hook. It's sexy and it's driving and you don't know where he's going with it. And he, the great thing about this EP is that it doesn't stick to one genre per se, but he explores experimental music and dance music, and just soul music. There's something organic about Pegasus Warning.
Okay, well, up next we have Brookzill. This is Suadade Songbook featuring Count Bass D.
Back to the essence, no need to question. Same melancholy of resurrection. Entrada and intro, now grip the halo. This is the glory, a never-ending story. Ashe Baba, Hotep Senep. Amen, Yamain, Yo Canto, Yo Saint. Ashe Baba, Hotep Senep. Amém, amém, eu canto, eu sei. Vamos dançar, celebrar no respeito. No need for sorrow, in mirrors I see you. Entrada and intro, all praises due. My praise to you, now begin life anew.
What a great sound there. And it's interesting also that you hear the English, and is that Portuguese?
That's correct. Brookzill is actually an interesting play off the name of Brooklyn and Brazil coming together under the moniker Brookzill. Suidade Songbook also features Count Bass D on the vocals. It's composed of Ladybug Mecca, who you might know from the Grammy Award-winning group Diggable Planets, legendary De La Soul producer Prince Paul's behind this, and alongside the Brazilian rapper MC Rodrigo Brandão, who's out of Zambalo. And they come together and they like to describe their sound as a throwback to the future. And what I love about this song specifically is that they sample one of my favorite Brazilian songs from Eli Carmargo. And the song is called Daeras. And I love the way Prince Paul flips the beats in a more modern day. Kind of, you can bob your head to it, walk down Brooklyn, enjoying the sun. It's got that vibe, you know?
Yeah, and now I think that living in Brooklyn is not even the hippest thing anymore. Now it's all about Brookzill. That's the new, that's where all the hipsters are moving to now. Well, Anthony, from Brazilian fusion rap to a very different sound, this is the New York group Onyx Collective with I Can See the Rain Clearly Now. I love that, and you have taken us to a very different place than we were just a moment ago.
Isn't that what music should do? Do you want to stay in the same place? Don't you want to travel through music?
Not.
You know?
No.
Well, these kids are out of New York, and I call it the Kamasi Washington effect, where now you see a younger audience embracing the sounds of jazz music. And the skate brand Supreme put this out, and which is interesting because they're a skate brand, but I love that they're fusing the skate culture with jazz music. And one of the great quotes about this band is from Fader Mag that said that Onyx Collective is injecting jazz cool into New York City's downtown scene. And I dig that.
All right, well, awesome. And let's go from New York to the Japan-born jazz artist Takuya Kuroda. This is Think Twice featuring Antibalas. Tell us about this one.
Takuya Kuroda is out of Kobe, Japan. He left to pursue music, settled in Brooklyn, Brookzilla, apparently now that it's called. And I met him. He was touring with Jose James, who's an amazing jazz vocalist. And he flipped this track, which is a Donald Byrd jazz classic, which is great to get folks on the dance floor with some jazz music. Teamed up with Antibalas, and he came to New York to study jazz music at the New York's New School. And now he dropped this incredible record called Zigzagger. And what I appreciate is that the title reflects how we proceed through life. A lot of times you have to zigzag, move left and right. And it's funny because when I listen to this record specifically, that song, there's a lot of moving left to the right. There's a lot of traveling. So, yeah.
This is the first of two selections that you brought us that come from artists born in Japan. Is there a lot of music coming out of Japan right now that you're seeing?
Incredible sounds coming out of Japan. I feel like they listen to what we're doing here in LA, and then they become a reflection. And a lot of times they tweak things, and they have this aesthetic. There's an appreciation. I've had the opportunity of DJing in Japan, and I can play a jazz record, and the kids will go crazy. I can't do that in LA. They love the music that we create, and I love the music that they create. And so there's definitely an incredible bridge between Japan and Los Angeles.
All right, well, let's get to the other Japan song you've got for us. This is Starro. It's called Kaku Renbo featuring Chara. There's the sexy sound that Anthony Valadez is known for.
I wish. That'd be great.
Well, tell us about this one.
Starro left Tokyo, and you know, one of the great bridges between LA and Japan is the internet. And this is a great example of an artist who utilized the internet, developed a fan base through the internet, and came to LA. And I did a show with him recently. KCRW did a show with him recently. And, you know, he had his audience there. And he was surprised that he had folks who love and appreciate his sounds despite living so far away. And he draws inspiration from the likes of Stevie Wonder, Sly Stone, and Bill Evans. And what I feel like is he is Sly Stone 2016. He really funks things up.
Well, and actually on his SoundCloud page, it says he's a producer slash multi-instrumentalist fusing beats with jazz, R&B, soul, chill, emotion, and love. So he puts a lot into it.
And you can feel it. And that's why I love his music. And that's why I support him on KCRW.
Anthony Valadez of KCRW joining us from Santa Monica. Anthony, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. Have a great day.
You too, and you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
A reminder, today is Giving Tuesday. Think of your favorite nonprofit. And it comes after several of the biggest shopping days of the year. As predicted by our and CBS's Jill Schlesinger yesterday, Cyber Monday racked in record sales for online retailers. But also, for the first time ever, millions more people shopped online than in brick-and-mortar stores over the Black Friday post-Thanksgiving weekend. Online is ruling, so let's bring in our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey is senior editor for Commerce at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Robin.
And tell us more about what we're seeing. For the first time, the online shopping outpaced in-store shopping. And this was over the three-day weekend. This was before factoring Cyber Monday in?
Yeah, that's correct. And it was, you know, for the last couple of years, it's been close. And there's been, you know, there's been maybe a slight edge to online in recent years. But this year was a considerable edge, about 44% compared to 40% of people said they were going to shop online versus in-store, which works out to millions of people. So it's just becoming habit. You know, the mobile phone is playing a big part. Bigger phones, easier to use websites and apps on phones have sort of made it easier to shop from your couch or wherever you may be with family over this weekend.
Well, you make an important point because we understand how people shop online is changing. This was the first year that more than $1 billion worth of shopping was done just on phones and tablets as opposed to computers. And this again over the Thanksgiving weekend. What is the significance of that for retailers?
Sure. I think it actually gives a big edge to the big retailers who already have the edge in scale. So especially, you know, companies like Amazon and eBay, which are technology companies and have been investing heavily in mobile apps, they have an edge just in terms of user experience. And then bigger retailers who can just, you know, who can also spend money to get their tech chops up to date. So I do worry a bit about smaller retailers in this world and whether we'll see, you know, greater market share move to the big guys each year with the move to mobile.
Well, you make the point, though, that the bigger stores, the brick and mortars, Walmart, are making bigger pushes to compete online. And so how is that working for them?
It's still a big uphill battle. One thing they're trying to do is offer incentives to get online shoppers to pick up their orders in stores in the neighborhood, you know, in neighborhoods mm-hmm. around them. That's basically a move to cut costs. Amazon has this huge network of warehouses bigger than anyone else, and so they can ship from relatively close to you no matter where you are. Not everyone else, traditional retailers, don't have that. So they're trying to drive people into stores. Maybe they'll buy something else while they're in the store and save a little money on shipping as well. But again, we're moving to a world where convenience trumps just about everything else for a lot of people, and so they really need to give value back to shoppers to get them to get out of their house and into a store.
Well, you mentioned Amazon, and Amazon is capitalizing on this momentum that's, you know, the wind at its back. It's doing so well. It's calling this whole week Cyber Monday Deals Week. Now, we were hearing from our financial experts that Cyber Monday, that a lot of these big shopping days are really kind of they're a fraud. You know, they're trying to move merchandise, you know. What did someone say? A lot of fire pits in the stores, you know, things that they're trying to offload. Is that also true? And is that going to backfire on places like Amazon?
You know, I think it's been going on for a while. You know, people, there are types of people who just love the idea of a deal or of seeing a discount sign, no matter what the product is. And so I think there will be a certain segment of the population that will continue to shop this way. I think people who take the time to really look over deals may be disappointed, and at some point, you know, this whole weekend may lose a bit of its impact. But really, you know, I think there are people who still love the idea of the weekend and the deal, and it's entertainment for them.
Well, I want to say we mentioned Amazon, and that's almost like saying Kleenex and meaning all tissue. I mean, there are other companies that might also be benefiting from this idea of, you know, online sales. Are there others that are, you know, having great success because of people moving to online?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are plenty of examples. Obviously, Amazon's the big one. Walmart actually acquired a young company earlier this year called Jet.com, which is another big mega store, but it's a young company, a startup. Walmart paid $3 billion for them. And they have a unique pricing model where you save more money as you order more items in your virtual shopping cart. And so they're benefiting partly by Walmart, partly by attracting some younger shoppers.
Jason Tilray, Senior Editor for Commerce at Recode, as online shopping is just ruling. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, I got to say, am I the last one that wants to go to the store, the small, locally owned store, and get the thing that I am?
Well, hopefully people are doing that too, although I just got another email saying Cyber Monday has been extended to Cyber Tuesday, so here we are. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.